FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's November 28th, 2017. November's gone, but there's still December ahead of us, and there's always next year. Well, you've been watching China, been watching Trump's diplomacy in China, the relationship that has emerged between Trump and President Xi, and seeing where this relationship's going. What are China's ambitions? What are they after? What's their vision for the world? And, well, someone who's written a book about it, interesting book called Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order. Hopefully it's a threat to the new world order. We don't know if we like that or not. Well, as always, be part of the show. Email us at kl@kerrylutz.com, Twitter feed at Kerry Lutz. So Stephen Mosier written this book, and hey, I think we should start with Trump's trip to Asia, what he accomplished, if he accomplished anything. So first, I welcome you to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
So two things I noticed about Trump's trip to China. If you remember Obama's last trip, the Chinese refused to wheel the stairway up to Air Force One,
right,
and he had to literally exit through the belly of Air Force One, mm-hmm, on steps, mm-hmm, that every plane, you know, retractable stairwells. The, mm-hmm, other thing, which I thought was, well, if you saw China's welcome of Trump, not only did they wheel the stairwell up to the plane, but the red carpet went as far as the eye could see. Hundreds of Chinese officials there greeting him with flags, and that was pretty major. One could say, well, they're just appealing to his narcissistic impulses. But the other thing which made me believe that that wasn't strictly the case was the reception that they had for Trump at the Forbidden City in a room that hadn't been used in 100 years. To the Chinese, the Forbidden City is like the Vatican is to the Catholics, or Jerusalem is to the Jews, or Mecca to the Muslims. The fact that they had that affair in the Forbidden City was pretty telling, wasn't it?
Well, it was, and you have to understand that the Chinese Empire, because that's what China is. It's an empire that survived into the present age, surrounded by nation states. The Chinese Empire is a past master at barbarian management, and everybody outside the magic circle of the Chinese ethnicity and culture and history is a barbarian by definition. And so they're very good at managing these types of events, and nothing happens by accident. Everything is planned out to the T, according to an almost Confucian ritual. So when President Obama landed in Hangzhou and was met with nothing, that was not an accident. That was a deliberate slight by China of a president that they saw as feckless, as a president they saw as almost irrelevant at that point. He made himself irrelevant, of course, by ignoring China trade violations and theft of intellectual property, for the most part, for his entire term in office, leaving the next president, his successor, President Trump, with a major problem on his hands. Trump, on the other hand, was greeted like a president of the United States should be greeted. His reception made us all proud. Obama's reception was intended to humiliate the country he represented, for good or for ill, for 8 years. So yeah, there's a lot in that we can unpack. It shows respect for not just the president of the United States, President Trump. It shows respect for the country and the people he represents. And I think the Chinese appreciate strong leadership. They certainly have a strong leader. I call him the new red emperor in Xi Jinping. He's known as President Xi, but he's much more than that. He's the generalissimo of the People's Liberation Army. He's the chairman of the military commission. He's the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. In the same way that Mao Zedong was, the first Red Emperor, Xi is described as the core of the party. Nobody since Mao has ever been described as the core of the party leadership. By that, they mean he's the center. He's the paramount leader. He's the number one guy. And I thought actually that Trump was very clever in before leaving for China, calling Xi Jinping, congratulating him on being elected, quote unquote, to another 5-year term. I think he'll be in office until he dies, actually. But he was very clever in calling Xi Jinping and saying that congratulating him on becoming the king of China, because he's actually more than a king. He's the new emperor of the new Chinese imperial red dynasty that we see unfolding before our eyes, and has a desire to recover China's lost place in the world. China's place in the world was always at its center, and she is very ambitious to put China back in the center of the Asian continent, put back China back in the center of the world. So, but Trump did, I think, what he described doing many times in The Art of the Deal. When you're negotiating, the first thing you have to do is you have to make sure you understand who the principal is on the other side. Who's the guy who's making the decisions, who's calling the shots? You don't want to be negotiating with a number two or number three or number four guy who can then at the end of the negotiation say, well, I have to run this back to my boss. It's a waste of your time. She is the boss. Trump has identified him, and Trump put pressure on him to do something about trade, do something about North Korea. And I think that's all to the good.
So he put pressure on him. Did he accomplish anything?
Well, I think the jury's still out on that. I mean, the Chinese excel at shadow play, not just barbarian management, but putting on a good show. So when they close the main bridge, as they did a few days ago, leading from China across the Yalu River at Dandong into North Korea, halting the cross-border traffic there, they claimed it was just for bridge maintenance, but it was certainly sending a signal to Kim Jong-il. And yet Kim just now fired off another ballistic missile. So, you know, we'll have to see what China does. China could shut down North Korea tomorrow. It would have to do two things. It would close the border with North Korea. That would cut off 90% of North Korea's trade. The second thing it would do is it would end its mutual defense treaty with North Korea. And yes, people heard me correctly. China has a mutual defense treaty with North Korea, pledging to defend North Korea in the event it is attacked. That's the only treaty China has with any other country. And if they were serious about reigning in North Korea, they could and they should cancel that treaty.
Agreed. So it is interesting, yeah, that they've taken a number of steps. No more direct flights to North Korea, right? They've done that.
And they said we'd no more direct flights because there's no passenger traffic. Well, that's another excuse, right? Close the bridge for bridge maintenance. Stop the airline flights because there's no passenger traffic. So you never get a straight answer from the Chinese leadership on this. They're playing, again, they're continuing to play both sides against the United States.
So the question is, though, what's in their interest now? Keep challenging the U.S. or work with the U.S.? What is in their long-term interest here? Because that's all they care about, right?
It is. They have a 100-year plan that the clock began ticking in 1949. And by 2049, a couple decades from now, they intend to be the dominant power on the planet. In fact, I think it's coming sooner than that. I think we're reaching a tipping point in 5 or 10 years, after which it will be difficult for us to recover. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, just testified before Congress that the looming threat is China. Russia and Islamic terrorism will fall by the wayside, he said. But by 2025, the primary threat faced by the United States will come from the People's Republic of China. So they do have a long-term view of things. We have a short-term view. I mean, we're governed by the election cycle. As I say, Xi, General Xi, President Xi, whatever you want to call him, Emperor Xi, will be in power. He's a relatively young man in his mid-60s. He'll be in power for the next 25 years. So he can afford to take the long view. We control our own destiny at this point. In 10 or 15 years, we won't. The cards will be in China's hands, and they will be able to do what they want, regardless of what opinions we have about it. So it's important that we get our act together, that we pass tax cuts, that we have economic growth, sustained economic growth for the next 10 years, because that, and probably only that, will really set back China's plans by a generation.
Well, now, when you look at China, though, They've been in the position of world dominance before or close to it. And they, as Henry Kissinger said, they managed to screw that up. Are they going to screw it up again? You know, they've got credit debt problems there that kind of make the U.S. look minute by comparison. They have been buying a lot of gold and silver, but it's questionable in the current economic environment what that really means. So what's going to happen here? Are they really as strong as they look? Or are they faking it? What's happening?
Well, there's always the Potemkin village aspect to any foreigner who's coming to China and looking around, because they put the best face is very important, and they put the best face on everything. A lot of the new high-rise buildings, office buildings, condominiums in China are still empty because China is terribly overbuilt. It's easy for well-connected officials who run construction companies to get soft loans from Chinese state, provincial, and local banks, pocket some of the money, and then build, say, a condominium complex that nobody wants to live in or can afford to buy. So there is a lot of that. There is a lot of charade. There is a lot of Potemkin village stuff going on. On the other hand, you've got 1.3 billion of the most enterprising, industrious, hardworking people on the planet. And they're simply trying to improve their lives. And, you know, if the Chinese Communist Party, a corrupt enterprise, if there ever was one, would simply get out of the way, China could actually grow economically a lot faster than it is growing now. But 25% of everything in China goes to pay off officials, goes into their pockets. A tremendous disparities of wealth in China, not governed by, you know, economic prowess. I mean, I don't fault the capitalist for doing well in his entrepreneurship. But what I do find fault with are Chinese communist officials who do nothing to contribute to economic growth, but yet pocket 25% of the of the GDP each year, generally into foreign bank accounts that they can get their money overseas. There's a huge pool of money in China, which is desperate to escape from that country because it is your property is not safe in China from confiscation, whether it be land or real estate or stocks. The government can always intervene if it wants to and take that from you, as it has done in case after case over the years. So there are reasons to think that China is vulnerable. They have a huge amount of debt, a lot of which is not on the books. Now it's a joke in China, but of course all jokes mask an underlying reality, right? It's sure. A joke in China that a businessman will keep three sets of books. The first set will be kept for his foreign partners to show that he's losing money.
Yeah.
The second set will be shown to his domestic partner to show that he's only making a little money and therefore has very little to share with his partner. And the final set will be his alone, and it will reveal the huge profits that he's actually making. So there's a lot of that going, financial subterfuge going on in China. But yeah, the debt bubble, if it collapses, will bring down the Chinese economy a notch or two for certain.
Isn't it?
The other vulnerability besides corruption, of course, is the fact that China has had a one-child policy in place now for 36 years. 400
disaster.
Million Chinese have been eliminated by the one-child policy. Some people would say that's a good thing. I think eliminating 400 million of the most productive enterprising people in the world is a bad idea.
If you're a Democrat, you definitely think it's a good thing, right? Hey, control the population at all costs. But it's been disastrous because you've got all these men with no women, and what are they going to do, right?
You also have that's destabilizing. You know, you got 25 million young men who will not be able to find brides. What do they do? Well, they don't get married and form families because the women they would have married were killed years ago. Do they engage in crime? Yes. Do they join gangs? Yes. There are a lot of social problems as a result. The aging of the population. And there is now a labor shortage, which began last year in China. There are 4 million workers short in China. The number will grow this year. How do you create a labor shortage in the world's most populous country? Well, you eliminate 400 million of the next two generations. That's how you do it. And I think the Chinese have ultimately made themselves poorer, not richer, by this massive government intervention into the right of parents to decide for themselves the number and spacing of their children. If you look at India's prospects, India has a younger, more dynamic population, and economists project that India's future growth will outpace that of China because it has a younger, more dynamic workforce to work with. China doesn't.
Yeah, that's interesting. They're kind of like in the same boat Japan is in, right?
Well, Japan is a lot further down that road. Japan's population has been shrinking since 2000. And that shrinkage, that is to say, Japan is filling more coffins than cradles each year. It's digging more graves than having births. They're selling more adult diapers in Japan these days than they are baby diapers.
Oh, God, yeah.
Now, that's not a good thing for a country. It's cutting into Japan's economic growth already, and it's forcing Japan to downsize their expectations for future economic growth. So, Japan is a lot further down that road than China is. But China is close on its heels. The Chinese population, because of the one-child policy, is aging more rapidly than I think any human population has ever aged. And that will have dire consequences for economic growth down the road.
Yeah, a little bit scary there. But yet, they've managed, when you look at all the problems in the world, and there are many, how important is not having a self-replenishing, if you will, population? How important is that?
Well, I think over the long run, it's the only thing that matters. I mean, a country that doesn't have enough children to maintain the current population, a country like Italy, where the population is shrinking from year to year, ultimately has to decide who it wants to give its country to, because obviously the Italians, the Japanese don't want their country enough to populate it themselves. So eventually other peoples will move in. There are lots of Filipino immigrants now in Japan, a country that historically has not been very welcoming of immigrants. There are a lot of people from Albania and other and Middle Eastern countries in Italy now, because the birth rate is about 1.3 children per couple, which is a recipe for economic disaster over time. So ultimately, it matters a great deal. Now, over the short term, of course, we have the Chinese economy still growing at 5 or 6%, and we have a huge number of surplus males who would make it very easy for China to recruit a large army, which it continues to do. So over the short term, it's not that much of a handicap. Over the long term, it would prove much more so.
And so China's relationship with Russia, probably many of you aren't aware, but China is effectively colonizing Siberia, because they're always looking for more resources. China is becoming a bit of a desert over time. And so the colonization, which Russia seems helpless to do anything about.
Well, I write in Bully of Asia about the fact that one of the consequences of having these 25, 30 million single young men is that they've gone overseas in large number. And there are probably now more Chinese living in Vladivostok than there are Russians. There may be more Chinese. The Russian population of Siberia is decreasing from year to year as the Russians, who were forcibly sent there by Stalin under the Soviet Union, are moving back to warmer climes. I don't consider Moscow to be particularly warm, but it's a lot better than, 50
yes.
degrees below zero week after week in Siberia. And the Chinese, the single Chinese are moving in. They're moving into the Central Asian countries. They're moving into Burma, Thailand, other countries along China's perimeter. Seeking brides, in part, seeking economic opportunities, in part. But I don't think that... I wrote in Bully of Asia that China wants raw materials from Russia, but Russia, on the other hand, does not want to become China's Canada. They don't want to become a second-rate power. And I think that Russia essentially put China on notice about 15 years ago when it said that any aggression against Russia would be met not with a conventional response, but with a nuclear response. Obviously, they can't match China in manpower, but they still have a very potent nuclear arsenal. Now, they put China on notice that any territorial claims against Russia and in the Chinese view, the Russian Far East was stolen from the Manchu Empire about 100 years ago, 150 years ago. In the Chinese view, much of Central Asia should belong to China that now is in the stands, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan.
Right.
So there are unresolved territorial claims. China has unresolved territorial claims at all points of the compass, to the east, to the South China Sea, towards India, and of course, towards the Russian Far East.
Yeah, interesting. And, you know, it's these things we don't think about. We just assume that that their interests are congruent, but in many respects, not the case.
Well, no country, I think, that shares a border with China is completely comfortable with that fact. Because, remember, from 1949 on, with the establishment of the People's Republic of China, over time, China has launched attacks on the offshore islands of Formosa, Taiwan. It has invaded Vietnam. It fought against us in the Korean War. It has had conflicts with the Soviet Union on the border of the river between Manchuria and the Russian Far East. It has had clashes with the Indian. Well, recently there were very, very dangerous clashes in the tiny protectorate of Bhutan, where the Chinese were moving in and building roads and territory that historically belonged to Bhutan, and the Indians sent troops in. So, China has a history of aggression against its near neighbors. So if you shared a long land border with China, as Russia does, you would be on your toes as well.
Yeah, definitely. Keep your friends closer and your enemies even closer, right? And yeah, so the U.S., are we on the right path to do this now under Trump, to contain them or confront them? Or is it over?
Well, I think, you know, we're 5 or 10 years away from a tipping point. I think we can postpone the day when China, then when these matters are out of our own hands, when we no longer control our own destiny. Right now, China's economy is still vulnerable to shock. It has this huge debt bubble. It has the problem of the aging population. I think we need to. I think we're on the right track. I think we simply need to do in trade what Japan does. Whenever China exports more to Japan than it buys from Japan, the Japanese Minister of Trade gets on the plane, goes to Beijing, and says, "We have to straighten this out. You have to buy more Japanese goods. Otherwise, we will have difficulties in our trade relationship." And magically, the trade gets back in balance. We've let things go far too long in China's direction. We've let them use non-tariff barriers to keep our goods out of their country. They've closed off entire sectors of their economy, the insurance sector, for example, to American businesses, while we've opened our markets to let them flood our country, fill our big box stores with Chinese-made goods. The World Trade Organization, which Trump criticized when he was in Asia, for not enforcing the rules. You know, he didn't mention China in that speech down in Southeast Asia. But that comment was directed towards China because China no sooner joined the World Trade Organization in 2000, no sooner was the ink dry on the document than they began violating the rules that they had agreed to abide by. They refused to open their markets. They refused to let their currency float. And they've been doing it ever since, and they've kept out Hollywood movies. They have a quota for the number of Hollywood movies that can be shown in China each year. So in area after area, in sector after sector, they've kept their economy closed while they've ransacked ours with thefts of intellectual property, with the ongoing cyber war, with the ongoing attacks in cyberspace against private companies, stealing proprietary data, and so forth. We've let that go on far, far too long. What we've seen over the last 20 years, I think, especially since China joined the World Trade Organization, is the largest transfer of wealth in human history from the United States to China. And that transfer of wealth has taken many, many forms. Currency manipulation is one. This unfair trade relationship is another. The theft of intellectual property is another. The idea that the recurrent situation where you have American companies invited to go into China, allowed to operate in China only if they bring in their cutting edge technology, only to have that technology stolen, their capital drained, and then to find themselves squeezed out of China by unfair competition from local competitors who have stolen their technology and are using it to produce goods at a cheaper rate. So that's the trillions of dollars have been stolen from us.
So is Trump the one to put an end to it?
Well, I hope so. Obviously, he's not a politician. He's not. Yeah. He doesn't act and or talk like a politician, which offends a lot of people. But he is a businessman. And he's interested in the bottom line. And I think the fact that he brought back 300 billion, I should say, orders for American goods and services back from a 12-day trip in Asia, it was a pretty good haul for less than 2 weeks of work. Part of that, of course, most of that are orders from China. Some of it are orders from Korea, with which we run a trade deficit, orders from Japan, with which we run a trade deficit. I think people in Asia treated him with respect because they know that he's watching the bottom line. They know that he's standing up for American workers and wants to bring jobs and factories back to the United States. You know, you cannot be a major economic power unless you actually make things.
Yeah.
Well, it's fine to talk about Silicon Valley and all of the internet and so forth, but there's only so much you can do in cyberspace. In real space, you have to make things. You have to make steel. You have to mine coal. You have to make cars. You have to make ships and planes. And if you don't have a manufacturing base, of course, you'll find it very difficult to defend yourself in the event of a conflict.
Mm. Yep. Agreed there. It seems inevitable. Anyway, Steve, just tell us where we get your book and your website, please.
Well, the book is called Bully of Asia, because I see China as a bully. And the way to deal with a bully, of course, is to stand up to the bully and then
kick
he
sand
will
in his eyes.
Slink away. You can get the book at pop.org, P-O-P.org, or you can simply go on Amazon. If you get it from my shop, I'll be happy to sign the copy before I send it out.
Oh, well, there's a good reason to go to pop.org, and we'll have a link to your site in the show notes to this interview on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Just go there, sign up for a newsletter, and look, we love you to be involved in the show. Stephen has made a lot of interesting points that I know will resonate with a lot of you out there. Email us at kl@carrylutz.com. You could Twitter us at Carrie Lutz. The Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. Steve, been a pleasure. Very enlightening and very thought-provoking. Good luck on the book, and we will talk to you again soon.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.